Psalm 62 is a song that is written by a man who has taken inventory of his life and has realized that even though he has done the best that he can, that ultimately his salvation depends upon the Lord. The title, of course, attributes it to David, and we would not think that it would be anyone else. The terminology fits his style. When he says, "My rock, my refuge, my strength," we've looked at such terminology in Davidic Psalms that have been studied before, and we find that truly this is his style. It was written to the chief musician, Jeduthun, and this was one of those who had been appointed by David to preside over the music of the tabernacle. And this is found in 1 Chronicles 25, verses 1 through 3. This psalm is designed to lead the reader or the singer. Remember that a psalm is a song that was sung by the Jewish people. So it's designed to lead the person who would sing this song to trust in God in times of despair and trouble. You will note as we read along verses 2 and 4 and 5 and 6, the word "only" keeps showing up. And some have called this psalm or have titled this psalm the only psalm, because David emphasizes that God is the only hope, ultimately, for the defense of those who are innocent. So tonight we want to look at Psalm 62 and consider it from this perspective. Notice, if you would, beginning at Psalm 62 and verse 1. David said, "Truly my soul waiteth upon God, from him cometh my salvation. He only is my rock and my salvation. He is my defense, I shall not be greatly moved. How long will you imagine mischief against a man? Ye shall be slain, all of you. As a bowing wall shall ye be, and as a tottering fence. They only consult to cast down from his excellency. They delight in lies, they bless with their mouth, but they curse inwardly." Selah. "My soul, wait thou only upon God, for my expectation is from him. He only is my rock and my salvation. He is my defense. I shall not be moved. In God is my salvation and my glory. The rock of my strength and my refuge is in God. Trust in him at all times, ye people. Pour out your heart before God. God is a refuge for us." Selah. "Surely men of low degree are vanity, and men of high degree are a lie, to be laid in the balance. They are altogether lighter than vanity. Trust not in oppression, and become not vain in robbery. If riches increase, set not your heart upon them. God has spoken once, twice have I heard this, that power belongeth unto God. Also unto thee, O Lord, belongeth mercy, for thou renderest to every man according to his work." David illustrates, or David conveys, his absolute trust in God, that God is his only source of deliverance. We find that musical pause, Selah, there at the end of verse 4 and at the end of verse 8. And so this would assist those who were singing it in the days of David, in the Old Testament times of Israel. This man is a man who has suffered a lot of problems in his life. David has been through a lot of distress. But the reality is that God's providential care and his miraculous care has saved him more than once, many times. And we talked about that last week, so I won't go back over that again. But just think about the life of David and how many times God had delivered him. So he says there in verse 1, "My soul waiteth," or waits. That word "waiteth" can be translated "silent unto God." The American Standard Version of 1901 says, "My soul waiteth in silence." There was a peace of mind that came to David because he understood that his future was truly in God's hands. And so he said, "My soul waits in silence." There is a peace that comes by knowing that God is the one who truly is in control. This idea, or this truth, is found in the New Testament as well. In 1 Peter 5 and verse 7, we are told what? "Casting all your care upon him, for he careth for you." David knew that God cared for him. He had seen it in his life. Sometimes we have to live through adversity so that we can look back on life and in retrospect realize the providential care that God has showered down upon us. And we need to do that. Albert Barnes, in his commentary on this verse, verse 1 says, "Such is the calmness, the peace, the quiet, the silence of the soul when all is left with God." He also says, David says, that from God comes my salvation. It was from God, and it was from God alone. Someone said, well, David had to do his part to be pleasing to God, to be faithful to the Lord. Well, obviously he did. But David knew that without God's blessing, without his help, that his enemies would win, whomever those enemies are at this point in time. We need to hear God, and we need to hear him through his word and his word alone. Too often the noise of this world drowns out the words of God. God has made promises. He's made promises throughout generations, and he's made promises to us. And we need to hear that. Though he has spoken once, we need to hear it many times and to seek it out, because that's where we will find peace and we will find comfort. We live in a world that is filled with turmoil today, and a lot of people are just taken aback by all the things that are going on. And there are many things that should definitely concern us. Brother Ron mentioned many of these in his prayer tonight. And we need to pray for our nation, and we need to pray for our leaders, those things that have already been mentioned. But the noise of this world begins to drown out. We listen to and we focus upon, dwell upon, meditate upon all the negative things, not realizing that God in the end is going to have his way, and that God will bless us, sometimes in spite of ourselves. But true peace is found in waiting on God and allowing him to direct us through his word that we have and that we hold in our hands. In verse 2, David said, he is my rock and my salvation. History reveals that God would not allow his word, his work, or his worship to be mixed with the false worship of the heathen gods that were worshiped by the nations that lived around and with Israel. In the Old Testament, we find very clearly that it was all God and only God, or there was no God at all. God expected them to worship him and him alone, being a very jealous God. So David, he didn't trust the idols of the land. He didn't trust his best counselors. David knew that he could not afford to look toward anyone else for his salvation but unto the Lord. In Acts 4 and verse 12, we should be reminded that we are told to do the same thing. And speaking about Jesus Christ, the writer said, neither is there salvation in any other, for there is no other name under heaven given among men whereby we must, not should or could, but we must be saved. There is no salvation in any other than Jesus Christ. In verse 3, he says, I shall not be greatly moved. David, from this terminology, lets us know that he did not expect a problem-free life. Notice, I shall not be greatly moved. But what he believed in and trusted in is that God would allow him ultimately to be victorious. Scripture frequently reminds us that if we're going to be faithful, that there will be problems in life. Paul said in 2 Timothy 3 and verse 12, yea, that all that will live godly in Christ Jesus shall suffer persecution. So David did not think that there would come an end to the problems that he had in life, but he knew that he could overcome through God's help. And that's what we've been told in the New Testament as well. Ultimate victory is our goal, and it is our promise. Paul said that he had fought a good fight, finished his course, and kept the faith. He said, henceforth there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, shall give me in that day, and not to me only, but to all them also that love his appearing. Is that crown something that we desire? Is it something that we expect? Is it something that we depend upon the Lord to give, because only he can give it if we have been found faithful? Last week, in a similar psalm, we read from Romans 8, verses 35 through 39. I'm not going back there tonight except to say this, that Paul said there is nothing in this world or out of this world that can separate us from the love of Christ. And that's our point. So in verses 1 through 2, what do we find? We find confidence. We find David expressing confidence in God, that God is his salvation. In verses 3 through 4, we find a challenge. The challenge is to his enemies. He asked the question, you remember when we read this, he said, how long will you seek to destroy me? How long are you going to do this? Well, isn't this the cry of everyone who is persecuted? Everyone who is having problems that have been inflicted upon them by another human being, do we not cry out and wonder, how long are you going to do it? And why are you doing it? If we have not done something to have brought this upon ourselves, we wonder, why is this happening? He uses the word mischief here, which implies both planning and the execution of evil. He says about his enemies, he said, "You're like a leaning wall and a tottering fence." Can you imagine the block wall that a retaining wall that is holding back the soil that is behind it? There was a bank over Mississippi that was built in the side of a hill, and they had built a retaining wall, but they didn't build it correctly. And don't say, well, that's because it was Mississippi. No, they just didn't build it correctly. But over the years, we would watch, and that wall began to bow and to bow and to push out, and one day, guess what it did? It just collapsed. Have you ever seen an old split rail fence that wasn't maintained, or a barbed wire fence that wasn't maintained, and the wire gets loose and the posts get a little bit wobbly, and you can almost go and just push it and the post will break off and fall to the ground? David is saying here, he's using illustrations that anybody can understand. He said, "You're like a leaning wall, a tottering fence. The leaning wall is weak and it's ready to fall, and the tottering fence is failing already, and it cannot protect. It could not protect his enemies against the judgment that God would bring against them." Verse 4, they consult. They consult. The idea here is that their only purpose was to find a way to destroy him, and they got together to try to work it out, to figure out a plan. They delight in lies. Again, verse 4, they would say or do anything to get rid of him. This may be a clue that indicates Absalom's rebellion because of his desire to take his father's throne. Well, how did he do it? He did it by lies. He did it by false friendships. He did it even by assassination attempts. And so David is saying, with all of these things that are going wrong, these people are consulting, telling lies one to another, doing anything to defame me and to hurt me, and ultimately to destroy me, even if it would come to the taking of his life. You know, it's bad enough, pardon me, it's bad enough to lie, but to delight in a lie, it's just beyond imagination. Revelation 21 and verse 8 lifts up, gives a long list of those who are going to be destroyed, or not destroyed, but punished eternally in hell. And listen to what the last part of that verse says: all liars. All liars shall have their part in the lake of fire, which burneth with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. All liars. Why would I delight in lies if it guaranteed that hell would be my eternal destination? So there's a challenge in verses 3 and 4, the challenge to his enemies. But then in verses 5 through 7, we find a conviction, or a commitment. You could use either word. They're really a repeat of verses 1 through 2, and they're not a boast, but they are an expression of complete confidence. There was a song that we used to sing years ago called "I Shall Not Be Moved." Like a tree standing by the water, I shall not be moved. And I think it was an allusion probably to Psalm 1, but there is the idea. David was not going to be moved away from his faith and his trust in the Lord. He was confident that God would save him. Note the individual emphasis, and you probably did already, by the personal pronoun "my" that is placed before the word "salvation" and "glory" and "rock" and "refuge." Again, in verse 5, "my soul wait thou on upon God." He is my rock, verse 6, my salvation, my defense. He is my salvation, verse 7, my glory, the rock of my strength and my refuge. David was looking at this very personally. He was determined he would not be moved. Well, have there been others that were determined not to be moved? You know, we think maybe about Peter. Peter, in effect, said, "I will not be moved." He told Jesus, you know, "Though all men deny thee, I will never do it." In Mark 14, 29 through 30, and then Jesus told him, "Yes, you will." Peter said, "I will not be moved." The Lord said, "Yes, you will." How many times maybe have we said, "I shall not be moved. Nothing will challenge my faith. Nothing will cause me to give up. Nothing will cause me to be discouraged." And then discouragement comes, and weakness comes, and perhaps the sin that follows. We need to be like David and say, "God is my strength. He is my salvation. It's my soul." It has to be personal if we are going to overcome. It's only when we determine to trust God completely that we will not fail, or that we will have the determination and the challenge and the hope of avoiding failure. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 58, "Be ye steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, for as much as you know that your labor is not in vain in the Lord." Steadfast, unmovable. What is that saying? It's saying, I'm committed. I'm going to make sure that I follow the Lord. Number four, then, in verses 8 through 10, we find counsel. We find counsel. What is the psalmist doing? He's calling out to others to follow his lead. He said, I am going to trust in God. He is my salvation, my rock. The psalm before this, my high tower, my place of refuge. And he says, you need to do the same thing. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 1, be ye followers of me, even as I also am of Christ. Paul said, there is a life, there is a hope. I mentioned before 2 Timothy 4, 6 through 8, Paul said, I've done those things and there's a crown of righteousness and you can have one too. And so we need to follow David's lead, putting our trust in the Lord. You know, only the person who pours out their heart to God in humble, with an humble request and with an humble frame of mind will find true peace. Someone wrote and said, humble confession is good for the soul. And it is. Why? Because as the Bible says, pride or a misplaced trust, what does it lead to? It leads to frustration. It leads to destruction. Pride goeth before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. David didn't have that kind of pride. David was not lifted up in his own mind. He was looking to the Lord. He said, the Lord is my help. I'm humbly following him, humbly approaching him. In this psalm, it was the enemies of David who were lifted up with pride. Therefore, it was the enemies of David who would be defeated. And then he talks about men of low degree and men of high degree. That is according to the rank of society, those that we consider to be of high degree or low degree. But when they're put to the test to determine true merit, both of them will be lacking. Verse 9, surely men of low degree are vanity, men are of high degree are a lie to be laid in the balance. They are altogether lighter than vanity. If the men or women, men and women or women, in whom people place their trust were placed on the side of a balance scale, even the things which seem vain or useless would carry more weight and cause them to go up. They would be lifted up. You think about a balance scale and you think about how that it would start. You would start off with a balanced condition and you would put something on the one side, let's say an ounce of gold. And the ounce of gold has weight or value. It has substance. And so that which, whatever was on the other side, suppose you put a feather on the other side. The side with the gold is going to go down. The side with the feather is going to go up. Why? Because that which is on the right-hand side of the gold, it is of substance and value. And so the psalmist is using something to help us understand. If you take the richest man and you take the man of high degree, the man of low degree, and you put them on the scale, and you would think that scale, it would tip the scale, and the things that are light and vain in life, that they would be lifted up. He said, no, it's the opposite. He said, when you put your trust in man, you don't realize that the light and the vain things, they're going to lift them up. They're going to be lifted up. Why? Because even the vain things have more substance in the eyes of God than the pride and the arrogance of humanity. And so David is saying about his enemies, you think you are that of substance, and I have been offset by your substance and your value. He said, but actually the opposite is going to be true. The opposite is true. He says here that their counsel and their strength would go up. In other words, it would be offset or outweighed by worthless or vain things. In the world, we look at people that have high status and we think that they are so important. Well, they are in the eyes of the world, but David said they're not in the eyes of the Lord. Well, then in verse 10, he talks about oppression. There is no strength, no true strength in oppressing others, though that has been the practice of tyrants throughout years to subject people to their whims and their desires. But he says there in verse 10, if riches increase. Well, you know, if we gain wealth honestly, it's no better than wealth that is gained dishonestly if we make it our God, if we worship it, if we prioritize it too much. In 1 Timothy 6, remember what Paul wrote in beginning at verse 9. Well, he says in verse 6 that godliness with contentment is great gain. But look at verse 9. They that will be rich fall into temptation and a snare, and into many foolish and hurtful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. And verse 10 is our key. for the love of money is the root of all evil. How many times do you hear people say, well, money's the root of all evil? No, it's not. It's the love of money. Money is nothing but a piece of paper. It has no intrinsic value. It only has value because we assign it value. But they that for the love of money is the root of all evil, which while some coveted after, have coveted after, they have erred from the faith and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. So David is saying here, even if these riches increase, we need to keep them in perspective. Why? Matthew 16 and verse 26, because riches cannot and will not save the soul. True riches are not those which can be held in the hand, but those which live in the heart. As Luke 12, 16 through 21 tells us, verse 21 tells us that we need to be rich unto God. That's where true wealth is found. In Matthew 6, beginning at verse 19, we remember that Jesus said, lay not up for yourselves treasures upon earth where moth and rust doth corrupt, and where thieves break through and steal, but lay up for yourselves rather treasure in heaven where moth and rust doth not corrupt. Thieves do not break through and steal, for where your treasure is, there shall your heart be also. Jesus said, like David, you need to be aware that riches are neither good nor bad. It's how they are used. Abraham was a very wealthy man. Job was a very wealthy man. Lot was a very wealthy man. Lot dwelt in cities that he needed, that he should have left many, many years before. But Abraham was a man of faith who walked after God, even though he was a wealthy man. Job was one of the greatest, most faithful people that ever lived, according to the book of Job. And it wasn't because he had money, it's because of the way he approached it, the way he dealt with it, the way he used it. His trust was in God. It wasn't in money. In James 1, verse 9, James says, let the brother of low degree rejoice in that he is exalted, but the rich in that he is made low, because as the flower of the grass, he shall pass away. The rich person can be dressed like Solomon in all his glory. The rich person can wear the finest clothes, can have the finest house, the biggest house, and could have all of the best toys. They can have the best of this world, but they're going to die just like everybody else. They're going to leave it all behind. And so one of these days, there's going to come a reckoning, and there's going to come a challenge, and what will be the thought in that moment? What shall a man give in exchange for his soul, the Lord asked, Matthew 16 and verse 26. But he said, the sun is no sooner risen with a burning heat, but it withereth the grass, and the flower thereof falleth, and the grace of the fashion of it perishes. So also shall the rich man fade in his ways. Look at chapter 2, verse 5. Hearken, my beloved brethren, hath not God chosen the poor of this world rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom, which he hath promised to them that love him? But ye have despised the poor. Do not rich men oppress you and draw you before the judgment seats? Do they not blaspheme that worthy name by which you are called? If you fulfill the royal law according to the scripture, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself, you do well. But if you have respect of persons, you commit sin and are convinced of the law as transgressors. So James warns us against looking at people or treating people because of what they have or because of what they appear to have. And David will tell us here, trust not in oppression, become not vain in robbery. If riches increase, set not your heart upon them. It's the same thing Jesus said, Matthew 16. Well, he concludes this with certainty, verses 11 through 12. Certainty. God has spoken so clearly on the subject that there is no room for doubt. He said, God has spoken once, twice have I heard this, that power belongeth unto the Lord. Though God speaks only once, it is the need and the nature of the godly person to seek out what God has said, to hear it as many times as he possibly can, so that we don't remember, so that we don't forget, so that we do remember and not forget. And God will render to every man according to his work. Look at verse 12 as he concludes that thought. Also unto thee, O Lord, belongeth mercy, for thou renderest to every man according to his work. When God meets out justice, he will do it with mercy. He will take into account our opportunities and our abilities and our heart and what we have, the choices that we have made according to our ability and according to his word. So God is a God of mercy, but he will judge every man according to his work. And this is far from being the only passage that talks about that. In Matthew 16 and verse 27, Jesus described the second coming, and he said, "For the Son of Man shall come in the glory of his Father with his angels, and then he shall reward every man, every person, according to his work." In 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 10, Paul said, "For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that everyone may receive the things done in his body according to that he hath done, whether it be good or whether it be bad." In Revelation 20, as the Bible comes to a close, our New Testament, in chapter 20, beginning at verse 12, John said this, "I saw the dead, small and great, stand before God, and the books were open, and another book was open, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged out of those things which were written in the books according to their works. And the sea gave up the dead which were in it, and death and hell," literally Hades, "delivered up the dead which were in them, and they were judged, every man, according to his works." He repeated that last part twice, "according to his works." Why do we normally repeat something? Is it not for the sake of emphasis? There is an emphasis that is placed on the fact that one day when we stand before God, he will judge us according to his works. And so David is standing here looking to his enemy saying, "How long will you persecute me? You can do what you want to, but I put my trust in God, and things are going to be okay. Because God will judge you according to your works. And though you're like a leaning wall or a tottering fence, your defenses, there's nothing you can do to defend yourself against God's judgment when it comes." David expresses, after looking his life, an absolute confidence in the fact that God is going to deliver him and that God will protect him. Trust. Trust. Do we have the kind of trust that David had? Well, it's hard to have that kind of trust. It's something that must be developed. It's developed by a study of God's Word, his promises, noting that no promise of ever God that God ever made was broken. None of his promises were broken. He always kept them. And he will keep the promises he's made to us. If you're here tonight and you've never obeyed the gospel, he will keep his promise to save you. And if you follow his will that is delivered and been delivered by Christ himself, believing in him and repenting of sin, being baptized, confessing your faith in him as the Son of God, and as a child of God, to walk in the light, to have that blood to continually cleanse us from sin, 1 John 1 and verse 7, knowing that when we confess those things that are wrong, that God will forgive. If you haven't already, let us all put our trust not in man, but put it in God. Do you trust him tonight? If you're subject to the invitation, would you come as we stand and as we sing?